Good morning, this is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the May 9th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the KZUX phone lines to get your takes on the world. Yesterday, 3 days ahead of a congressionally imposed deadline, President Trump formally withdrew the United States from the JCPOA. The agreement, largely negotiated by Secretary of State John Kerry and signed in 2015 by Iran and the five members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, that ended Iran's nuclear enrichment program and included an inspections regimen that precluded Tehran from initiating a nuclear weapons program before 2025. Ironically, Trump delivered his message standing before a portrait of George Washington, who in his farewell address warned Americans against having, quote, passionate attachments, end quote, for foreign nations. Our first president, I suspect, could not possibly have anticipated the passion that Trump and so many members of his administration, not to mention Congress, have shown for Israel. But then again, Washington probably couldn't have envisioned that the desires of a future generation of wealthy Americans to spend unlimited amounts of money to purchase the votes of members of Congress and shape the decisions of his presidential successors would be considered by the Supreme Court as free speech and the law of the land. The headlines of two Israeli newspapers summed up the president's action. Defying world, Trump says U.S. withdrawing from Iran nuclear deal was the headline of the online Times of Israel, while the venerable Dedi Haaretz's English edition headline said, told the story in its anticipated outcome, quote, Netanyahu doctrine, Bibi's fix-it-or-nix-it moment on Iran is finally here. After nearly a decade of trying, the paper's Anshul Pfeffer wrote, Netanyahu is finally about to see the U.S. administration adopt his doctrine toward Iran. But can it work, he asked. Well, that's what I'll be inquiring about later in the program when I speak with Sasan Fayez Manesh, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Cal State University Fresno, author of Confronting Iran, Obama's Policy of Tough Diplomacy, and more recently an opinion piece on Counterpunch, Trump, Iran, and the Fate of the JCPOA Nuclear Deal. Stay tuned for that interview at 20 minutes past the hour. Trump's performance yesterday was predictable. After a brief introductory sentence, he launched into the mantra that has become the standard fare for Israel's political class, its lobby in the U.S., and Trump speechwriters that, if passed as prologue, will go unchallenged by any mainstream journalist. Quote, the Iranian regime, said Trump, is a leading state sponsor of terror. Clearly reading from a teleprompter. It exports dangerous missiles, fuels conflicts across the Middle East, and supports terrorist proxies and militias such as Hezbollah, Hamas, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. Over the years, he said, Iran and its proxies have bombed American embassies and military installations, murdered hundreds of American service members, and kidnapped, imprisoned, and tortured American citizens, end quote. The evidence supporting most of these claims is either non-existent or flimsy. They largely date back 35 years to 1983, when Hezbollah formed in resistance to Israel's occupation of Lebanon following its invasion of its northern neighbor the previous summer, ostensibly to drive out the PLO. Since that invasion and the casualties and destruction it caused have been erased by the media from the American public's memory, the president's description of Hezbollah as an Iranian proxy and as a terrorist organization has no domestic challengers. If the U.S. allies and NATO do not share Washington's designation of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, it's something you're not likely to read or hear. What you most likely have not read or heard is that Hezbollah and its Shia Christian and Sunni allies scored major gains in Lebanon's parliamentary elections on Sunday as the main Western-backed faction headed by Prime Minister Saad Hariri lost a third of its seats. As the Associated Press reported, but few U.S. newspapers printed, quote, the results of Sunday's election further bolsters Iran's allies in Lebanon and neighboring Syria at a time when Tehran faces growing Israeli threats and the prospect of the United States pulling out of a landmark nuclear deal negotiated with world powers. They also underline the growing clout of the group in Lebanon where it dominates politically and militarily, the AP story noted. Hariri acknowledged that the losses at a news conference in Beirut on Monday, but said, quote, it's not the end of the world. The international community said should look at the results in a positive way because they reflect democracy in Lebanon. He blamed his losses on a new election law and a performance by his political party that was, quote, wasn't up to standards, end quote. As for Trump, he has clearly fulfilled his campaign pledge to tear up the Obama administration's signature foreign policy achievement and re-implement sanctions against Iran and any country doing business with Tehran. But in doing so, he went against the advice of his Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, the hawkish House Foreign Affairs Committee Chair, Ed Royce, Washington's three most important European allies, and almost two-thirds of Americans who believe the U.S. should not withdraw from the deal, according to a CNN poll released yesterday before Trump's announcement. Trump made it obvious for some time that he is determined to undo as much of what Barack Obama accomplished as possible. In addition, notes the Loblaw's Eli Clifton, quote, the sheer perversity of his personality may well explain today's action. But, Clifton goes on, it may also be useful to follow the apocryphal advice that Watergate's famous deep throat offered Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and all the president's men, particularly in the unbelievably corrupt swamp of the Trump era. Indeed, suggests Clifton, yesterday's unpopular announcement may have been exactly what two of Trump's biggest donors, Sheldon Adelson and Bernard Marcus, and one of his biggest inaugural supporters, Paul Singer, paid for when they threw their financial weight behind Trump. Marcus, owner of Home Depot, and mega-billionaire casino owner Adelson are board members of the Likud-supporting Republican Jewish Coalition. Both have already received substantial returns on their investment. Total alignment by the U.S. behind Israel, next week's move of the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, and the official dropping of the term occupied territories by the State Department to describe the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Adelson, as I have pointed out before, was Trump and the GOP's biggest campaign supporter. He and his wife Miriam contributed $35 million in outside spending to elect Trump, $20 million to the Congressional Leadership Fund, a super PAC exclusively dedicated to securing a GOP majority in the House of Representatives, and $35 million to the Senate Leadership Fund, the Senate counterpart, in the 2016 election cycle. Whatever most Americans think of the president, there is no question about his popularity with most Israelis. Yesterday, Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat announced his intention to formally name the square near the U.S. Embassy site, quote, the United States Square in honor of President Donald Trump, end quote. An official event with American dignitaries will be held in the future to celebrate the naming, his office announced. This is the way in which Jerusalem returns love to the president and residents of the United States who stand by the State of Israel, said the mayor. President Trump decided to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the Jewish people, stand on the truth, and do the right thing. That's the view of the mayor of Jerusalem. While Palestinians in Palestine and around the world are mourning the loss of their homeland, Israel will be commemorating its 70th anniversary next week, and the U.S. Embassy is moving to Jerusalem to coincide with the independence celebrations. It's a strong symbolic gesture, but there are several more concrete steps Washington should take now to help ensure Israel's security and protect its own interests in the Middle East, according to an opinion piece in Bloomberg News. If one of its authors was not retired Admiral James Stavridis, it would not be worth reporting. But since Stavridis happens to be a former commander of U.S. forces in Europe, including NATO, a columnist for Time magazine, and as a frequent talking head on the news networks and NPR, what he has to say should be carefully scrutinized. In the article, co-authored with Michael Makovsky of JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, who Colin Powell blamed for the Iraq War, we are told that, quote, Israel's very existence is threatened by Iran's nuclear program, which continues in the form of expanded atomic research and ballistic missile development, which are unfortunately permitted by the 2015 nuclear deal. The intelligence trove revealed by Israel last week, they say, confirms Tehran's determination to acquire nuclear weapons capability. Not a surprise, certainly, but a clear warning of potential danger ahead, end quote. Even if, as the U.S. media has accepted without a murmur, the existence of a half-ton of documents that Netanyahu claims were pilfered from a secret, apparently unguarded location in Iran, were what he says they are, They confirmed nothing of the sort. If his presentation was made to change the minds of U.S. allies who were a part of the agreement with Iran and who hoped to maintain it despite Trump's attempt to wreck it, he failed utterly. That Netanyahu made his presentation in English has led observers to conclude the dog and pony show was cooked up with and for Trump's benefit, and for the likes of Stavridis and Makovsky, although apparently they didn't need it. But the most important threat, they write, to Israel and the U.S. interests isn't Iran's nuclear program, but rather Tehran's stunning expansion of influence. Its entrenchment in Syria, for example, they write, generates ever greater prospects for a major Iranian-Israeli conflict. Iran and its proxies also threaten America's Sunni Arab allies, seek sway from Lebanon to Yemen, create more jihadists and refugees, put energy supplies at risk, and target U.S. ships and Saudi cities and missiles, end quote. Anyone taking a look at the number and locations of U.S. military bases surrounding Iran can see that this statement is nothing more than Israeli propaganda, but it leads them to the next step. Quote, the U.S., they argue, must support its allies in the growing confrontation with Iran. It should seize upon Israel's longstanding ethos of self-defense and the newfound readiness among Sunni Arab states to defend their own interests and work quietly with Israel against Iran. Washington also has legal obligation to ensure Israel's qualitative military edge over its neighbors, Stavridis and Makovsky point out, which happens to be true. Maintaining Israel's QME, or qualitative military edge, has been a long-standing tradition that every president since Lyndon Johnson has honored, but had not formally become U.S. law until approved by Congress in 2008. For Stavridis and Makovsky, this would best be done, quote, by front-loading the 2016 Memorandum of Understanding signed by Obama, under which the U.S. is providing a record $38 billion in foreign military and missile defense funding spaced evenly over 10 years. That's $3.8 billion a year. A fast-track MOU, they suggest, could allow Israel to acquire a host of weapons earlier than initially planned to meet growing threats from Iran and elsewhere. On their gift list are F-35 fighter jet squadrons, that's squadrons plural, with each plane costing U.S. taxpayers over $100 million, KC-46 air refueling tankers, mobility capabilities like V-22 tilt-rotor aircraft, small-diameter bombs and Hellfire precision munitions, and joint direct attack munition kits that turn unguided bombs into smart weapons and drones and semi-submersible naval vessels. They seem to forget that Israel already is one of the world's leading producers of drones, and that thanks to the kindness of the German government, Israel already has a half dozen submarines that are said to be armed with nuclear missiles. More bewildering is their call for, quote, the U.S. to replenish Israel's precision munitions and other critical wartime stockpiles and consider making Israel a pre-positioning base to support American and allied regional operations. This has, in fact, been the case since the first President Bush created such a base in 1991 in order to placate Israeli Prime Minister Itzhak Shamir and keep Israel from participating in the first U.S.-Iraq war. In their air assaults on Gaza in 2012 and 2014, Israeli forces made good use of the pre-positioned weaponry, which was provided free of charge. Finally, at least for this report, they called on the Pentagon to consider relocating two Arleigh Burke-class destroyers from Rota, Spain, to a new home port in Haifa. These ships, they argue, with their, quote, cutting-edge Aegis combat systems, would be well-positioned to defend Europe against an Iranian missile attack, balance the new Russian naval presence in the Eastern Mediterranean, and reinforce Israeli deterrence, end quote. The likelihood of an attack of any sort on Europe by Iran is as remote as it could possibly be, and the Europeans who want to do business with Tehran would be the first to say that. But that expression of ignorance, like the entire article, like the pro-Israel sycophancy of the president, reveals the extent to which Washington has surrendered American sovereignty to a foreign country. And add up what retired Admiral James Stavridis, who formerly commanded U.S. forces in NATO, and I should remind you, and Jensen's Michael Makovsky are pushing for in their article, and the answer appears to be another Middle East war. Finally, a story that released this issue that you're not likely to hear or read about elsewhere. On August 20th, 2015, the Department of Energy released under the Freedom of Information Act its guidance on release of information relating to the potential for an Israeli nuclear capability, officially numbered WPN 136, that was in order prohibiting any government employee from acknowledging Israel's possession of nuclear weapons. It implied that Israel might not yet even have nuclear weapons, even though a majority of Americans believed otherwise. The official reason for publishing the gag order has never been acknowledged, except that the Symington-Glenn Amendment of 1971 proscribes U.S. aid to any country involved with nuclear weaponry outside of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, which clearly applies to Israel. What's clear is that is one of the reasons that federal employees and government contractors, including presidents, avoid giving direct answers when questioned about Israel's nukes, and why Israel's nuclear arsenal hasn't been mentioned in the Iran deal debate, is because any federal employee who does so can be summarily fired, as happened in one instance, and possibly go to prison. In 2016, Grant Smith of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, and a frequent guest on Takes on the World, filed a lawsuit alleging that WNP 136 was an illegal legislative rule with a single purpose: to facilitate the unlawful delivery of the lion's share of the U.S. foreign aid budget to Israel, a nuclear weapons state, in violation of the Arms Export Control Act. Federal district and appeals courts refused to conduct in-camera review of the two-page WPN, despite multiple requests to do so, before dismissing the lawsuit a week ago today. Both courts claim that Smith, the plaintiff, cannot avail himself of the Administrative Procedures Act to challenge the systematic undermining of the Freedom of Information Act for unlawful ends. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.